Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Well, who would be better to put into perspective President Obama's announcement just a few days ago with respect to Cuba and our changing relationships with that country? Who better than Carolina's expert on Cuba and our neighbor, Luis Perez, the Carlisle Citizen Professor of History at Carolina? And also, Lou, editor of the Cuban Journal, you've been keeping up with this and all kinds of books and everything that you've talked to.
Emeritus editor.
You're emeritus editor now. Oh, that's the best place to be.
Exactly.
But you, for many reasons, have been educating us and counseling us about the United States and its views of Cuba and our relationships with that country. So, did the announcement that the president made the other day catch you by surprise, or did you know it was coming?
A little bit of both.
Uh-huh.
There was surprise because no one expected this to happen at any specific point as of yesterday morning. But there have been rumors and innuendos and words circulating around the people who work on study with Cuba that something was afoot. Nobody knew what, but something was afoot. Not for the first time these rumors circulated, but there were rumors mm-hmm. on this occasion that there was something afoot. And one of the telltale signals of this is the frequency with which the New York Times ran editorials on Cuba. I'm going to guess that the New York Times ran an editorial every month, every 3 weeks, for the last 6 months, 9 months, urging a change of policy, urging reconsideration of existing policy, urging this, urging that. And I suspect they ran more editorials in the last 6 months than they have in the last 10 years on Cuba. So this is the New York Times, which is a newspaper of record. And so it's clearly that there's some kind of public opinion being prepared for something to happen.
So I'm putting words in your mouth, but your thinking is that the administration was carefully giving clues to the newspaper of record, the New York Times, that there might be a change if they would help fan a little bit of public opinion in favor of it.
I'm not sure I can make that cause and effect. It's just it seems to be striking and coincidental uh-huh. that the New York uh-huh. Times was in fact so insistent on editorials.
Let me ask you to do this because we've read the headlines, and everybody who hears the headlines or reads them knows that there has been a very important change from the U.S. standpoint and from the Cuban standpoint about our relations. But if you pushed me to tell you exactly what the change is, I'm not sure I could outline it. Can you kind of summarize what has been done and what is what we might think has been done that really hadn't been done?
This is a momentous first step. And I underscore both the word momentous and first step. When the president of the United States indicates that he has had a conversation with the Cuban president, a 45-minute conversation, it is something that has not occurred in perhaps 50 years, 55 years, so that we have now a dialogue in progress. It is a first step in the sense that we are now looking at a whole new paradigm in relations between Cuba and the United States.
Lou, excuse me for interrupting you, but you mentioned, I'm thinking recognition, ambassadors, trade increase, or maybe those things. And you're saying the first thing that comes to your mind is the President of the United States talked to the political leader of Cuba.
Right.
And that's more remarkable. Important than anything else.
That's remarkable. It has been the conventional wisdom is that American heads of state, presidents, vice presidents, first ladies are not to be seen talking with or photographed with Cuban leaders. That is at social events, at professional events, at any number of events, so that when President Obama shook the hand of President Castro at Mandela's funeral about a year ago, the uproar in this country was palpable. It was everybody just focused on that image of the president leaning to shake the hand of the Cuban president, And it would become something of a Rorschach test. What did that signal? What did that mean? And because it is so, it was so unprecedented. This was a public event, very much photographed, very much filmed, and the president, without hesitating, extended his hand to the Cuban leader, and that was historic. And so that they have a conversation for 45 minutes, in which they apparently seal the deal and talk about the things that they're going to agree on. They both gave their talk at the same time, yesterday at 12 noon, and each one presented his case for what was achieved, what was negotiated, and what remained to be done.
Well, let me get back to what was achieved. What are the outlines of this agreement?
Well, the President of the United States has embarked on a curious policy. He has determined that it's time to change a policy that for 55 years has not produced the desired result. This is a policy that was designed initially to bring down the Cuban government. Economic sanctions, what we know as the embargo, had as its principal purpose the creation of difficulty, adversity, hardship on the Cuban people, hoping that these measures, these adversities, and especially after the collapse of the Soviet Union, would produce restlessness in Cuba, and ideally might even produce an uprising of the Cuban people to overthrow the Cuban government. Obama made a very key point in his comments yesterday where he said it is not in the American interest to seek the collapse of Cuba. And that indeed has been the purpose of sanctions. So what has transpired is the United States and Cuba have agreed to exchange embassies, to exchange ambassadors. There is an effort that there is now little more freedom of travel. More remittance can be sent to Cuba more often. American travelers who go to Cuba are now able to use credit cards. Banking regs are in the process of being modified. And there is now the expectation that this prepares the way for future discussions and negotiations on outstanding issues. Now, what does not change is the embargo. That is, the policy of economic sanctions remains in place, and that is a function of Congress and congressional will to change or not change the policy of embargo.
One of my buddies sent me an email in the middle of the day yesterday, or several days ago, I guess now by the time we air this, said, "Let's go," and with the idea that that it was wide open to visit Cuba. One person was quoted as saying, "I can go to Key West, get in my speedboat, and I can be in Cuba in 2 hours," with leaving the impression that we can now travel to Cuba like we could travel to Mexico. But that's not quite right, is it?
Well, there are two points. Number one is, no, not anybody and everybody can travel to Cuba. There is this sense that once the United States lifts travel restrictions that the Americans are going to pour into Cuba. And I think it's worth mentioning that Cubans determine who goes to Cuba. And so it's a bilateral process. So if your friend gets in a speedboat and goes to Cuba, it is very likely that he will be stopped not by you at the U.S. Coast Guard or the U.S. Navy, but by the Cuban Navy. That is two sides of one coin here. So,
Now that you're mentioning that, stay with it for just a moment. Is the policy of the Cuban government, as we understand it now, that it wants to restrict travel, or it would not welcome unlimited travel from the United States now, or would it? I mean, I just don't know. Maybe it's in their view that, gosh, we can use these American dollars coming in. We'd like everybody to come. Welcome. We'll take care of you.
You know, I'm not sure how this gets resolved in terms of the number of tourists that are going to be permitted or the number of visas that are going to be issued for Americans to come to Cuba or go to Cuba as tourists. It's hard to imagine Cuba becoming in any near future, perhaps a long way away, any near future, Havana or the beach cities of Varadero in the Keys somehow becoming a site for American undergraduate spring break. Okay, I can't quite get over that bend in the road to see
what, what's holding you back other than history?
Now, to what degree tourism? Tourism is an enormous source of foreign exchange, but I'm not sure that the infrastructure of tourism of Cuba today is sufficiently adequate to accommodate an inundation of hundreds of thousands of foreigners. Of whatever nationality.
Well, again, I don't mean to press you on this because I know so little, but my impression has been that Europeans and Canadians have been taking advantage of the vacation opportunities that have been available to them in Cuba and enjoying it, and that there is a support network for out-of-country tourists.
That is correct. Yeah. That is correct. Cuba is a popular tourist destination for Western European countries, as France, England, Spain, certainly the Canadians fill Cuban beaches and hotels during the winter months.
So Americans could just go and display some of them. You're saying it's not that the Cuban government may not want them to come. It's just that if they're going to be hordes, they're going to have to have some capital expenditures to take care of them.
I think tourism, like any other economic social activity, has to be modulated, has to be arranged so that tourism is a double-edged sword, and the Cubans are learning, in any society, any tourist system that has a kind of first world, third world direction of tourism creates all sorts of social problems in its wake. It's an enormous source of foreign exchange, to be sure, and in that sense, it is a salutary economic activity for the Cubans to pursue. At the same time, tourism brings prostitution. Tourism brings corruption. Tourism brings in a lot of unwanted activity that almost follows the tourist dollar almost inevitably. So I think Cubans have had enough experience, certainly an experience with this in the 1950s and to some degree in the last 25 years, that one proceeds very carefully, one proceeds very judicially, one proceeds very thoughtfully in how they open up the island to foreigners. Mm-hmm.
No, it's interesting because you think of the communist movement in one sense as being this sort of lifestyle, that's not healthy in terms of developing a healthy public. So that and you think of Castro reacting to the sort of the mafia infiltration of Cuba during the Batista era. And your thinking is that there's a holdover from that sort of thinking, that people remember how it was when Cuba was essentially seeded as a vacation gambling haven for American tourists.
No, the history of tourism in Cuba, specifically the history of American tourism in Cuba, is an industry that was generated by commercialized vice. That is to say that the things that Americans couldn't do at home is what they opted to do in Cuba. And it starts off in the late 1910s, 20s, and 30s during Prohibition. The spike in Cuban tourism in the United States, excuse me, really is a function, number one, of World War I, when the transatlantic leisure class tourism was suspended because of German submarine warfare, and all those luxury liners were diverted to Cuba. Cuba became a very, very chic place. The rich and the famous, Babe Ruth, Mayor Jimmy Walker, movie stars all flocked to Cuba, and after them, the rising middle class also joined Cuba. This is the 1920s. Where changing lifestyles, changing morality is unfolding in the United States, and it's transported to and influenced by Cuban culture, Cuban music, Cuban dance, and you could drink. And there was something like in the immediate years after Prohibition was introduced in this country, something like 7,000 bars that opened up in Havana. Many of them bars from American cities that just picked up the saloons and transported them lock, stock, and barrel to Havana in the principal cities. So there is this sense of commercialized vice, and I'm not sure I want to put drinking in commercialized vice, but certainly Americans in the 1920s thought drinking was a good thing. The American authorities, American governments, American officials thought drinking was some kind of vice. Gambling. As the Americans are outlawing racetracks and racetrack gambling, they are transferred to Cuba. And then, of course, during the late 40s and especially during the 1950s, after the Kefauver hearings, after the anti-crime, then organized crime in this country begins to migrate south and to Cuba and opens up gambling casinos, prostitution. They get into hotels. They get into all sorts of activities that are reaching the apogee, happens to coincide with Batista's military government of the 50s. And so Americans are not going to Cuba the way they're going to London. Okay? Americans are going to Cuba to indulge their libido. The Americans are going to, and I say libido, and I'm talking about men and women who are going to Cuba for sex. Men and women are going to Cuba to drink. Men and women are going to Cuba to gamble. That's why the overwhelming majority of people went to Cuba.
Well, I tell you what, we need to take a break. I need to catch a breath from all of this sin that you're talking about. And again, if you join us late, I'm visiting with Professor Luis Perez. We're talking about Cuba, and he's been giving us a history lesson on the Cuba before Castro. He and I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Professor Luis Perez is visiting with me. We're doing it in the context of the president's recent announcement of a change in our relationships with Cuba, and Professor Perez has been our leading expert and consultant. I say our, been the country's leading expert and consultant on American relationships with Cuba and about Cuba. And so he's helping us sort of put this change in perspective. And Lou, just to get back to the president's announcement, is this just one small step in a series of steps that have been going on for the last 10 or 15 years, moving Cuba and the United States towards a rapprochement? Or is this something that will go down in the history books as a big day in the history of relations between the two countries?
I think it's, as I said at the outset, I think it's a momentous occasion, and this in several regards. Not only does the United States address itself to Cuba directly and engage Cubans directly. But in point of fact, what the President of the United States was doing yesterday by talking to Cuba, he was also talking to Latin America. The road to better relations with Latin America passes through Havana. Almost every country in Latin America has normal diplomatic relations with Cuba. In fact, almost every country in the world has diplomatic relations with Cuba. And so the United States has seemed to be unable to get over itself with regard to Cuba. The Cold War is long over, and for any number of complicated reasons, and some not so complicated, the United States continues to maintain a policy that was set in place during the Eisenhower-Kennedy administration. I think that's 10, 11, 12 American administrations have come and gone, and the United States has steadfastly adhered to a policy that every single American political leader has agreed has failed, and yet we continue to maintain a policy that has failed. So when the President of the United States indicates a willingness to bury the hatchet, to engage in dialogue, to engage in conversation, to negotiate, to recognize the existence of a government that has been a thorn in the side of the United States for 50-plus years, a government that has, in part, defied American pressure. We are talking about a government that a people that have been subjected to invasion, to covert operations, to economic sanctions, to assassination plots, to a whole host of activities. And whereas the Soviet Union collapses, the Cubans are still there, and they just seem sort of like they just seem unable. The United States seems to unable to get rid of this country that just is 90
But we
miles
did.
Away.
Did we?
What?
When the president a few days ago said, "We're going to recognize Cuba and we're going to have set up an embassy and we're going to receive their ambassador," and they've agreed to do that. That's.
I think the significance of that is an indication by the United States of a willingness to coexist with a government with whom it has profound differences.
Let me ask you this: when we made our rapprochement with Communist China, with whom we had an even greater fear and adversarial relationship, I think, than an appreciation of the danger and the antagonism, the demonization of their government and their people. Once that happened, we pretty rapidly became partners and friends in many respects. Not that the challenges of relationship with China are over, but a whole cluster of economic relationships of mutually beneficial and healthy competition between the two countries developed. Wide open relationships in many respects. Do you see after this event of recognition, do you see a similar sort of falling away of the barriers to communication and trade and personal friendships?
My sense is that we can't lose sight of the fact that the embargo is still in place. And the embargo is going to stay in place until it is revoked by an act of Congress. It is not likely that Congress, as it will constitute itself in January, is going to be disposed to lifting the embargo in Cuba. So at this moment, any possible expansion of economic ties is probably not going to depart from what we have known for the last 10, 15 years. What I think happens is what the American government has determined is that and China is not as a good model as Vietnam is.
That's another model that I'm looking at that, you know, sworn enemies, and not just covert operations against each other, but we were bombing them and they were fighting us, killing our guys, so that there was a whole bunch of baggage that we brought in the relationship, and now all of a sudden we are, not all of a sudden, but over a sustained period of time, we've developed into partnerships on many levels with Vietnam.
Yeah, I think the arguments that we used to justify the rapprochement with Vietnam was that the process of engagement was expected to be far more fruitful in moving bilateral relations into the desired condition, that by engaging, by communicating, by doing cultural exchanges, by developing trade relations, by being present in each other's societies, that somehow this relationship would have an ameliorating or salutary effect on conditions in Vietnam. Whether that's been achieved or not is really beyond my area of knowledge. That's certainly what the American government is doing now with regard to Cuba. And the president said this very eloquently. He says, we have adhered to a policy that for 50 years has failed, and it makes sense that we try something else. And it's clear that the American government seeks to use its access to Cuba and Cubans and the Cuban leadership that it has not had to try to persuade, to try to cajole, to try to get them to do the things that the United States wants them to do. As a process of political dialogue, political exchange, diplomatic communication. The Cubans, for their part, and President Raul Castro's speech yesterday afternoon reiterated several times that the Cubans entered into this new relationship with the United States, fully committed to upholding the principles of national sovereignty and self-determination. That the principles of the revolution that have their origins in the 19th century have been defended, and they will be defended, and they will be engaging the United States with respect, and expect a mutually respectful dialogue between both countries.
We're visiting with Professor Luis Perez, and we're doing it in the context of the recent president's announcement of the restoration of diplomatic relations and other ties with the Cuban country. Professor Perez, and I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. If you join us late, I'm visiting with Professor Luis Perez, professor of history at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill and expert on U.S.-Cuban affairs and relationships. Lou, trying to look down the line at what is left to do and what will happen naturally. One of the things that the United States faces, as you pointed out earlier, is that in the Congress, particularly with a pretty large Republican majority in the House and a significant majority in the Senate as well, to the extent that there is a political divide, it is mostly Democrats who kind of lean towards supporting the president's action. And many Republicans are opposed to it. But there are exceptions. Do you watch the U.S. politics with respect to attitudes about Cuba? And how do you see it shaping up in Congress and also the political winds that shape congressional opinions in terms of how the ordinary people in the United States are going to react to this and push for more or to demand that we pull back?
I think the conventional wisdom is that most Americans, insofar as they think about Cuba at all, are probably baffled. Certainly anybody under the age of 40. We have diplomatic relations with countries that are far more distasteful to American sensibilities, and we seem to be untroubled by those relationships. We denounce communism in Cuba, but we engage communism in Vietnam and China. So what I think an American citizen looking at this picture would say, well, there's something wrong here. What is the situation that we can't travel to Cuba? What this policy does in its most fundamental sense, it abrogates American right to travel. That is to say that the right to travel is already recognized by the Supreme Court a constitutional right. The U.S. government tells the American citizen that you cannot travel to Cuba. And therefore, those people who want to live up in the Northeast or maybe even in North Carolina who are tired of the winter and want to spend a month in a warmer climate cannot go to Cuba because the U.S. government will not allow them to go to Cuba. So it's an infringement on American constitutional right of travel.
Well, is that the way the people of the United States are sizing it up? Are they – was this important to them?
As I said, insofar as they think about it, and not everybody thinks about it, but insofar as people begin to think about this, I think an informed public, people who are aware of U.S. foreign policy, people who want to travel, there is a sense that there was an anomaly here. There is something not quite right with a policy that penalizes Cubans and then engages Vietnam.
There's an impression, I think, about that what really drives the sort of the anti-Castro, anti-rapprochement with Cuba movement are the residents of Florida primarily and other states as well who are either Cuban refugees or descendants of Cuban refugees from the time that Castro took over, and that they're the main movers. And that so there's the impression that if you want to win Florida either as a gubernatorial candidate or as a presidential candidate, you have to pander to the views of that segment of the Cuban community. Are we stuck with that for a while?
I think that's a myth. I think
that why do you say that? Excuse me for just jumping in, but I'm faced with the quote, first of all, by Senator and presidential candidate Rubio, who says this is – I mean, he just it was a disrespectful thing, in my view, that he said about the president, that he's the worst negotiator, that he's terrible, and that he's given in to the – so he was – he must have some platform. I mean, he must be on a platform to speak to some constituency.
A couple of questions have crashed here.
I'm sorry. I got going.
I think Senator Rubio is playing a risky game. I think he may be losing sight of the demographic to South Florida. There is a profound shift underway in the Cuban-American population for the last 25 years. The recent polls indicate that a significant minority of all Cubans, something like 47% are not hostile to normalizing relations with Cuba. When you begin to kind of recalibrate that, fine tune that, then you see that by certain age cohorts, something like 88% of Cuban Americans who are under the age of 30 want normalization of relations. This past semester, I had students in my class, four or five Cuban Americans. A group of them were out in the pit at the university protesting the embargo. I mean, they are the new demographic, and they live in Miami. And so what we have here is a changing demographic, a changing electorate that I'm not quite sure to what degree, and I'm assuming that Senator Rubio has a whole staff of very talented pollsters. Yeah. One assumes. But on the other hand, we also know that it's changing. It's a rapidly changing demographic. And the most important thing to bear in mind is that the overwhelming majority of the people who Cuban Americans who live in Florida have emigrated from the island since 1990. That is to say, most of them still have family in Cuba. Most of them want to travel to Cuba. Most of them are sending money in forms of remittances to Cuba. So anything that alleviates, that ameliorates the condition of their friends and family, their parents, their children, their siblings, their aunts aunts and uncles, is going to be a welcome development. I just don't know how this plays out. It plays itself out with regard to Rubio's elections.
Well, something that shocked me more. I guess I wasn't really shocked with Senator Rubio, whose views on this are shaped by more than public opinion, perhaps, but because of his background with his family. But former Governor Jeb Bush, who's probably going to run for president, at least is testing the waters. And his comments reported were almost as untypically for Jeb Bush, were emotional and vicious in terms of his evaluation of the president's action. And it was, if I read that right, do you think he was just pandering to a group in the Republican Party, or has he got better senses of what might be going on than you and I have in terms of public opinion throughout the United States?
I don't know. I claim no expertise in American electoral politics. I can tell you that, I mean, what I'm reasonably certain about it, looking at the population of Florida politics, is that the Cuban-American vote has been held hostage to an American policy. Everyone who has campaigned either in primaries in Florida or in national elections in Florida have presumed that the way to reach the Cuban-American vote is to bash Castro. That has been the dominant trope of electoral politics of American politicians since 1960, 65, probably since the end of the 60s. And everyone goes to Cuba, and I remember Clinton saying he was going to bring the hammer down on Fidel. And everyone goes to Florida to campaign in the Cuban-American communities, and everybody vows that they're going to be the president who's going to go, quote-unquote, liberate Cuba. And everyone has failed. And that there is a kind of fatigue setting in, even among the older Cubans who have heard this again and again and again and are weary of campaign rhetoric that produces no, you know, post-election results. And so what we have then is a young generation who is sufficiently cynical to say, you know, the policy hasn't worked.
So let me just push you on this in terms of your – all of our knowledge about voting is imperfect, but in your impression of the Florida vote, that if the issue in the next presidential election were with the Republican candidate saying, I'm going to roll back what the president did and we will be right back where we were before the announcement of recognition, I'm going to – we're going to go back to a policy of unfriendliness with Cuba and try to bring down the Castro regime. And the Democratic candidate comes in and said, I support what President Obama did. We need to work towards better relationships with Cuba and to work to influence the Cubans through example rather than force. And you think the Democratic candidate might win?
I think they'll split the vote, and Democratic candidates have carried Florida, the Cuban vote notwithstanding.
Well, we're visiting with Professor Luis Perez. We're talking about the new developments in Cuba, and he and I will be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm talking to Professor Luis Perez, and if you know anything about the University of North Carolina Chapel Hill, you know that we're proud that he's on the faculty there and for the international recognition that he's achieved as an authority on Cuba, on American views of Cuba. And Louis, thanks for coming and helping us sort of put this very important event in perspective.
Thank you for the invitation.
You know, you live in Chapel Hill, in one sense, our neighbors don't go around talking about Cuba all the time. It's not at the top of the list of
concern. My neighbors do all the time.
At your house. of concern. But what difference will it make to those of us who live in Chapel Hill or in North Carolina? What are there economic opportunities? Will we be the beneficiary of a slight diminishment in tension with one country? Or is this just one of those things that we read about in the papers and say it's interesting, good that we're going to be friends instead of enemies? How's life going to be impacted?
What happens in Cuba really does have direct implications for the citizens of North Carolina. Some years ago, and now I'm embarrassed to say I'm blocking her name, she was Secretary of Agriculture, and she went to prison.
Yeah, Scott.
Yeah. She had undertaken several trips to Cuba.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember speaking with her about ways that we at the university could facilitate and open up opportunities for trade with Cuba. I have been in Havana and seen in freezers in Cuban supermarkets turkeys from North Carolina. I think the state has much to gain in terms of expanded trade relations with Cuba, whether it's pork, whether it's poultry, whether it's vegetables and fruits. Cuba is a market for North American, for North Carolina agricultural products. And we have been trying to figure out ways where we can communicate with the Department of Agriculture and then hook up with the Cuban authorities, the Cuban intersection in Washington, maybe take a – because, Scott, she did go – she did take two trips to Cuba.
She did. This is a Meg Scott Phipps. Is it? Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
And she did an op-ed piece that appeared in the most North Carolina newspapers speaking of the importance.
So there would be an opening when the trade embargo is adjusted, when trade embargo is adjusted.
There's been trade now because the Cubans are buying a great deal of their agricultural products from the United States. The difference is they can't buy on credit. So they're buying on cash, on a cash basis. And on that basis, there's been considerable trade between the United States and Cuba. And as I said, I've seen North Carolina products in Cuban supermarkets.
Well, you have friends and family in Cuba, and
no family.
You have friends in Cuba. And just focusing on one person, you. What difference does this make to you in your life, either in terms of just the satisfaction of seeing something move along, or in terms of what opportunities it really might open up for you?
It's important because we have a Cuba program at the University of North Carolina. And anything that could facilitate travel and ease movement of people helps my students. We have graduate students doing research on Cuba. We have exchange programs with Cuba. We have a study abroad program in Cuba. We bring Cubans here to inform our students and our community. We bring Cuban filmmakers. We bring our artists in residence. So anything that expands the horizon and enhances knowledge of both countries, I think, is all to the good.
Well, you mentioned that you're bringing the Cubans here, and in just a minute, what is it? The Cubans have had a different experience than we've had, and they've maybe done some things better. What are some things that we as Americans or as an American country can learn from Cuba on the positive side?
Learn to dance.
Is that all?
No, of course not. I think there's much to learn from Cuba, and I talk this with my students. I think it would be useful for the United States, for Americans specifically, and maybe the world at large, because Cuba, to see how Cuba survived the 1990s, because Cuba was the first post-petroleum country in the world. Here is a country that faced a rude and dramatic drop in access to petroleum products. And this economy came to a grinding halt, and they survived. They got out of that. And so what we have here is a marvelous, fabulous study awaiting any number of scholars, and I hope they come from Carolina, saying, how did a society adapt to a virtual absence of oil and survive?
Well, other things. What about medicine? The
Cubans have a very, very sophisticated and advanced culture of medicine, and they're working on all sorts of vaccines that have potentially far-reaching implications in healthcare. Cuban medical attention, Cuban healthcare system.
Would you come back and talk to me some more about this as the days pass and we see more about what this big event means. In the meantime, though, Professor Perez, thanks for coming and sharing with us your thoughts about the restoration of diplomatic relations with the Republic of Cuba.
Thank you.
Thanks to all y'all for listening. This is D.G. Martin, who's talking. I'll be back here before you know it.